This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In New York City today, thoughts were of the lives lost on September 11th, 2001, and of how much so many things have changed since then. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, sponsor of Retirement Revolution, airing on PBS September 15th at 9 p.m. Eastern. Local listings at pbs.org. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Friday. Glad you could be here with us, everybody. The president offered his remembrances and condolences for the events of September 11th at the Pentagon today. He will be at Federal Hall in New York City on Monday, right across the street from the New York Stock Exchange. He will be speaking there just one day short of a year since the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the gut-wrenching beginning of this financial crisis. Lawrence Summers is one of the president's key economic advisors, one who's working on the administration's plans to re-regulate the financial industry. Mr. Summers, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
What is the president going to say on Monday to convince people that this administration has a handle on how to prevent something like Lehman Brothers and this whole financial crisis from happening again?
He's going to highlight that 9 months ago, the conversation was about whether recession would become depression. And that today the conversation is about when the recession is going to end. He'll highlight that we've got a long way to go, but that the emphasis can now shift from rescue to recovery.
What we've heard from the White House really so far the past 6 or 9 months, and the Treasury Department as well, is some speeches about consumer protections, foreclosure prevention programs, the Treasury Department's white paper. What is the White House doing right now to make Wall Street safer for investors?
Right now, the level of regulation, the insistence on capital adequacy, the insistence on transparency is very different than it's ever been. People can see much more clearly the situation of each individual financial institution, but I don't want to say that everything's returned to normal or that things are satisfactory, but I think it's hard to look at almost any financial indicator and deny that some real progress has been made.
You know, a lot of things came together at the same time to cause this financial crisis and the collapse of Lehman Brothers a year ago. What, in your mind, was the most important thing that happened?
I think it was the culmination of a very long period of complacency and excess confidence in which people lost their moorings in terms of evaluating risks without any real framework of government protection.
Was it an absence of protection or these banks just working around the regulations that were there, this thing you're trying to fix?
I think the satisfactory regulatory framework wasn't in place, and that enabled banks, while complying with the law, to do things that were highly imprudent. You know, as somebody once said, the scandal isn't usually what's illegal. The scandal is some of the things that are legal.
Well, if that's the case, then can we stop this from ever happening again, no matter what kind of work you do on regulations?
I don't want to say after 3,000 years of financial history that we have seen the last financial crisis, but I certainly think we can make our system much less vulnerable than it has been by providing for much more capital, by protecting consumers, so you don't see the kind of predatory subprime lending that contributed so much to bringing about this crisis by stopping the kind of race to the bottom competition between regulators.
You know, along those lines, a lot of the banks seem to be pretty healthy now. Stock market's doing all right. Consumers are feeling better. Have we wasted this crisis in terms of capitalizing on the fear and the problems of Lehman Brothers?
I don't think so. I think people remember this. We've still got millions of homeowners who are underwater on their homes. We've got an unemployment rate in excess of 9%. We've got a government that's very focused on this. I hope and trust we will not see a return to complacency, but you're right to give the warning. Too often that's happened after past financial crises, and that's why moving rapidly on financial regulatory reform is so important to us.
Lawrence Summers, he's the director of the White House National Economic Council. Mr. Summers, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, the mood, as in much of lower Manhattan, was somber. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. How about this for a blast from the financial past? Sovereign wealth funds. Before the global economy went south, those huge pools of government-controlled capital were all the rage, in the oil-rich Middle East especially. But Bloomberg News reports today that Dubai's fund is going to stop making investments. Just like the rest of us, sovereign funds have had a rough couple of years. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York that some of them are starting to pull back.
Sovereign wealth funds have exploded in the last several years as countries made investments abroad that offered high returns. Mark Levinson is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says many of those investments turned out to be pretty risky.
Many sovereign wealth funds have lost money. That is a hard sell politically. And so I think one of the issues that many of the sovereign wealth funds and the governments that run them now have to deal with is explaining to your population why you've lost money by investing in another country.
Part of the explanation is a lack of expertise, according to Kevin Kajiwara, the director of Global Markets for Eurasia Group.
One of the real constraints that a lot of sovereign wealth funds and sovereign investment vehicles have had, and this is even more the case in the Gulf, has been one of human resources. They just don't have the numbers of professionals available to manage a lot of these investments.
We've heard a lot about sovereign wealth funds in recent years, especially when they stuff their money into high-profile investments like Ferrari or the Chrysler Building. But Kajiwara says these days the funds are trying to keep a lower profile. Just look at China's fund called CIC.
What you're seeing is them using their Swiss arm to invest in hedge funds and private equity funds and be much more quiet about how they're taking their positions.
Still, Kajiwara says Americans shouldn't be too concerned about the woes of sovereign wealth funds. Sure, they dwarf the hedge fund industry, but they remain much smaller than other institutional investors like pension funds. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
After a lot of hemming and hawing, it looks like Bloomberg, the business news service, will indeed make a bid to buy Business Week, the magazine. McGraw-Hill put it up for sale a couple of months ago, and it has generated a lot of interest. Which is funny, because isn't print media dying? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
In the first half of this year, Business Week's ad pages were down by nearly 37%. Ads were way down at other magazines, too. That is, the ones that are still standing. Even so, there are nearly a dozen interested buyers sniffing around Business Week. There's Bloomberg, there's the owner of New York Magazine, the owner of Fast Company, and a slew of private equity groups.
This is recovery economics.
Media analyst Ken Doctor says Business Week might be losing money now, but the brand is in a good position to grab a big chunk of the $24 billion online advertising market.
Business advertising online often fetches 3 to 4 to 5 times as much as general news. And so it can be a lucrative category, especially in a recovery.
Business Week offers advertisers an attractive audience, one that's affluent, educated, and influential, says Jeff Jarvis, a journalism professor at the City University of New York. He says Business Week's niche also gives it an advantage as more media move online.
On the one hand, weekly magazines are in dire trouble. Time and Newsweek as general interest publications aren't really needed anymore in the age of the internet where we can find out anything we want, anytime we want. The Business Week brand is just focused enough to be very valuable.
Maybe not as valuable as it once was. 10 years ago, Business Week pulled in more than $100 million. This year, it's expected to lose about $40 million. McGraw-Hill hasn't said what it hopes to get for the magazine. Bids have to be in by Tuesday. I'm Stacey Bannock-Smith for Marketplace.
Year-end financial results from some of this country's richest colleges and universities are in, and it is not pretty. Overall, they were down about 30% last year. Harvard's endowment lost $10 billion. Yale gave up $6 billion. Public universities that depend on state revenues are even worse off. The president of the University of California is recommending a 15% tuition increase to fill the budget hole there, as Joel Rose reports.
If the fee hike is approved, tuition at University of California schools will top $10,000 for the first time. That hurts students.
But it needs to be viewed in the context of other forms of pain.
Spokesman Ricardo Vasquez says UC is already cutting positions and using furloughs to save money.
The academic quality that students and parents expect from UC is being threatened.
Vasquez says the university has no choice but to charge students more as the state loses tax revenue. It's the same story across the country, with state schools raising tuition and scaling back financial aid. That's according to University of Pennsylvania education professor Joni Finney.
Right now, we're in the worst recession we've seen for 30 years. And what other major industry is raising prices on consumers? We haven't asked the tough questions about restructuring for the long term.
Those include how to improve college readiness in secondary school and whether to beef up teaching loads at research universities. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
A note now about yesterday's broadcast. We were talking about the cost of President Obama's health care plan, and we quoted an analyst from the Lewin Group, which we called a nonpartisan consulting firm. What we should have said was that it's a consulting firm owned by United Health Group, which is in turn a major health insurance company. All right, here's today's curious coincidence fact of the day. The Dow Industrials finished this Friday at exactly the same place they closed on September 10th, 8 years ago, 9605. That seems to be as good a place as any to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. To do that, we've got Lee Gallagher with us from Fortune Magazine, also Andy Brooks. He's the chief U.S. equities trader at T. Rowe Price in Baltimore. Lee, Andy, good to talk to you both again.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Mr. Brooks, since we haven't had you on in a while, we are going to start with you and the question of the markets in September. Traditionally a terrible month, really. September 09, not so bad.
Yeah, I think actually the market's been just terrific. We've had a furious rally here since the lows in March and a little backing and filling in September, but this last week's been great. I think the market's up close to 3%, so overall there's a pretty good tone in the market.
I was going to ask you about that backing and filling, though. Sort of seems like things have stalled just a tad, huh?
Yeah, it does. I think we're doing a little bit better, but there is a sense of a stall. And it's interesting. I was looking at the price of crude oil, and crude oil has sort of stalled around $70 here over the last 3 months. And the market's in a period of consolidation, which is generally, I think, a pretty good thing and often leads to the markets moving higher.
All right, Lee, put that into macroeconomic context for me here. Do we deserve to have, oil falling and stocks going up?
Well, I'll say one thing. I mean, I think that this rally has been so terrific as to be suspicious. I mean, there is a lot of good news out there that the market's been responding to. We're seeing, M&A's returning. We had strong second quarter earnings. There are some good economic news, things like housing prices may be turning around. But if you look at the bigger picture, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be worried that's buried even in all that good news. I mean, the financial system is still, we don't quite know what's happening there. And is there more bad things to happen to the banks around the corner? Housing prices, sales are up, but a lot of that is driven by foreclosures and distressed sellers. And a lot of those earnings were driven by cost cutting. So we still don't have real revenue growth, real rising wages, and things that typically produce recovery.
Speaking of the financial crisis, obviously this is right around the time of Lehman Brothers from last year. Andy, is there any sense that investors and traders are nervous at all, that they're thinking about that?
I don't think so. But boy, it's amazing to think it was a year ago. It seems like a lifetime ago. That was such a painful period. And when you combine that with the anniversary of 9/11, it's been an interesting week emotionally, I think, for traders.
Lee, your thoughts on Lehman Brothers from a year ago?
I would absolutely agree. I mean, I think what's happened this summer just puts that in all the greater contrast. I mean, it's amazing that a year ago, really, it seemed as if we were on the brink of the entire collapse of the entire financial system. And now, not only did that not happen, but we are kind of, you know, roaring back.
Lee, we had Larry Summers on up at the top of the broadcast, the chairman of the White House Economic Council. We were asking him about regulations and whether the government's going to be able to fix things. Are you confident that Congress and the White House actually have a plan and a way to get new regulations done?
Well, I was when they came out with the big plan several months ago. But there really has been little mention of it since. And we may all, yes, get universal health care finally, but this seems to have been forgotten. And there were many ambitious programs that were suggested, but there has been little talk about regulation. And I think that it's easy to take one's eye off that ball, but it's really important.
All right. Well, then, Andy, crystal ball this for me. The last 3 months of 2009, which we're about to get into here, what are they going to look like for the market and for the economy?
I guess my sense would be the following. I think on the margin, the economic news that we're getting and going to get is going to continue to be a touch better. October is always a tricky month for the market. There are lots of memories of terrible markets in October. But I think we're going to be higher at year-end than we are today. I think investor confidence is picking up. People feel better about things. And I appreciate that people want to be careful about the risk they're taking. But if you need a return, you've got to take some risk. So I think the markets are going to do better.
Andy Brooks from T. Rowe Price in Baltimore, Maryland. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, the continuing effects of September 11.
So we stopped, and I think a train hit us in the back, and then people just started flipping out and running.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 22 points today, a quarter of 1%, closed at 96.05. The Nasdaq dipped 3 points, a tenth of 1%, ended the day at 2080. The S&P 500 lost 1 point, a tenth percent, finished at 1,042. For the week, the Dow climbed 1.7%. The Nasdaq charged up 3.1%. The S&P 500 rose 2.6%. FedEx delivered a gain of 6.4% today with a better-than-expected profit forecast, getting the credit for that. But the falling price of crude, as Andy was talking about, it offset that news. Crude dipped below $70 a barrel. ExxonMobil, Chevron, Hess, and ConocoPhillips each fell about a percent or so. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In New York, President Obama delivers a speech on the financial crisis. In Washington, a Senate subcommittee on labor, health, and human services holds a hearing on the health effects of cell phone use. And Jay Leno moves from late night to prime time. The Jay Leno Show premieres at 10 p.m. Eastern on September 14th. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Centers for Disease Control said today that swine flu is present in all 50 states, but also that tests on a vaccine for it are moving along and should be available in a month or so. Small businesses are wishing there was a flu shot they could get. If lots of employees are out sick, as expected, there is some work that just won't get done. And at a congressional hearing this week, businesses from credit unions to doctors' offices warned they might need a little bit of government TLC to get them through an outbreak. From the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Banks and credit unions file a lot of government paperwork, and usually they can't get an extension because our CPAs were all out sick. But Anthony Demingon of the Credit Unions National Association says that's what they might need this time around.
In a pandemic, their ability to respond to regulations and comply may be temporarily stunted to a certain degree, and we just kind of hope that regulators take that into account.
Demingon says credit unions just want to be cut some slack if they've planned for the flu and still can't make the deadlines. Of course, at many companies, it's the employees who aren't cut much slack. If they're not given paid time off for being sick, they'll come to work and infect others, increasing absenteeism. Jillian Steele Fisher of the Harvard School for Public Health says while three-quarters of companies offer some paid sick leave,
about a third of businesses offer paid leave for people to care for sick family members, and even fewer offer paid leave if the schools or daycares are closed due to such an outbreak.
Harold Jackson owns a medical supply company in Colorado. He's not looking for government help, but he does want a robust public health campaign to minimize the epidemic. And he's got his own plan to fight the flu.
The deal I've cut with my employees is we'll give you the shot for free, and if you have to have time off because either you're ill or your children are ill, we'll cover the expense.
Doctors, meanwhile, say giving all those flu shots is going to be costly. They're asking for higher Medicaid reimbursements. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Throughout the country today, people are remembering the terrorist attacks of 8 years ago. This anniversary also marks the first National Day of Service and Remembrance. President Obama designated this as a day for volunteerism earlier this year. And for a lot of people, the memories have faded some with time. In New York City, though, September 11th is still very much on people's minds, as our New York Bureau Chief, Marketplace's Amy Scott, reports.
I got a taste of how skittish New Yorkers still are earlier this summer. I was on the subway at Wall Street Station. Suddenly, what sounded like an explosion came from the back of the train. People poured out of the cars and ran for the exits. I joined them. One of my shoes fell off, so I kicked off the other one, not sure I'd ever see them again. Outside on the sidewalk, we tried to figure out what had happened.
So we stopped, and I think a train hit us in the back.
Nicole didn't want to give her last name.
And then people just started flipping out and running. So I tried to walk, and then it was like, walk or get trampled. So some man shoved me into the wall.
Another passenger, George Nassef, worried it might be a biological attack.
Have you ever seen anything like this before in New York?
9/11.
You were here for 9/11?
Yeah.
So is this kind of reaction understandable
to you? The panic is reminiscent of that. I don't know what actually happened. It could have been a compressor could have blown for all we know, but it was a loud enough bang to get everybody running, so.
Only after I'd recovered my shoes and made my way to the office did I find out what had happened. Some cables had fallen onto the train, making the loud noise. Heavy smoke had forced the evacuation of the station behind us. But nobody was hurt. Everything was fine. I couldn't help but feel a bit sheepish for being so afraid.
I think it is a New York state of mind.
Paul Light teaches public service at New York University.
I think memories have faded over time. But I don't think it takes much for people to jump.
Light says that state of mind has helped the city prepare for the worst. He's been studying disaster readiness at businesses, nonprofits, and government agencies. He says New York holds up well.
I think New York gets it. The police department's very good. Businesses have worked very hard. We're still relatively weak on transportation, some vulnerability in the ports, cargo, and so forth.
Light says businesses all over the country aren't worried enough about cyber threats, and he says the financial crisis and recession have taken some of the attention away from security. Chris Grenet is a consultant with Kroll Security Group. He says financial firms facing billions of dollars in losses are focused on survival.
If they're in a crisis of their own, and let's talk about the major banking institutions, I don't believe that the senior management of those organizations are particularly focused on the day-to-day security issues.
Grenet says firms that have to cut costs may be tempted to cut back on security. But he says many financial firms invested heavily after 9/11. They built backup facilities in other cities. Many New Yorkers worried the big financial employers might leave Lower Manhattan altogether. Elizabeth Berger says that didn't happen. She's president of the Alliance for Downtown New York. Berger points out Goldman Sachs plans to open its new $2 billion headquarters downtown this year.
Bank of New York is here. Deutsche Bank is here. AIG is here. There are a variety of financial firms, large and small, that are still here. Of course, with the paradigm shift in financial services, there has been some shrinkage. That's not deniable. But Wall Street remains Wall Street.
And New Yorkers carry on, even with the anxiety that comes from living in a city that's been a target. One image stays with me from my own subway scare, a security guard standing in the basement. As all of us went running past, he stood like a brick wall, calm and stoic, ready for whatever came. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a break from the headlines, a chance for Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan to do their thing. That is, ask the Marketplace staff about the news that didn't make it to air. Something you might want to talk about at a dinner party.
George Judson, managing editor for Marketplace. What's your story this week?
How to choose a grocery line.
How do we choose a grocery line? The fastest line.
Well, mathematicians would say it's random. You can't do it. But this is a great world, and someone has taken hours and hours to investigate. Is the express lane faster?
And so what did we find out?
No.
Is my name mentioned anywhere in this article? Because I think...
You're the guy who is trying to pay with a check in a cash-only line?
I'm the guy who went to buy milk and it turns to feta by the time I get out of there because it's taking me so long.
Jeremy Hobson, New York reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Rico, you know, there's always a problem keeping doctors awake because they work such long hours.
Indeed.
Well, Queensland, Australia has a really interesting idea to save a little bit of money. Just give them more coffee.
So instead of hiring more doctors, they're saying how many cups of coffee should a doctor drink?
4 to 6 cups a day, and they've also recommended sugary snacks.
And then when they get all stressed out and jittery, I guess the prescription is a bottle of gin.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What's your story?
Well, the Prime Minister of Bangladesh has banned government employees from wearing suits, jackets, and ties.
Why would he do that?
Because he wants to save money on air conditioning, so people are supposed to have, like, untucked shirts and, you know.
So this is the sort of things we need to do for the environment, like not wear ties, shorter work weeks. I think we can get into it.
I know. Save the planet. Wear hot pants.
Just like we all do at Marketplace.
That's right.
Speaking of, there goes Kai and his clam diggers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, not really. That is, though, just a taste of what Rico and Brendan have to offer. Their whole podcast is called The Dinner Party Download. There is a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. The radio show is called Marketplace. It's from American Public Media. Today, on this Friday, the Dow lost 22 points, a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 3 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 shook off 1 point, also a tenth percent. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, we are saving more than spending for the first time in a long time.
And emergency funds are sexy. Who would have thought that would ever happen?
Go figure that out. We are back here Monday afternoon, same time as usual. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.